listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Well, we all have heard about young people getting themselves hooked on prescription medicines in recent years. But did you know that taking some of those medications, such as OxyContin, has led young, white, suburban people to become addicted to opiates, such as heroin? Opiate addiction has been moving to the burbs. Dr. Alex Zafiris is my guest today here on Full Power Living, talking with me about the new face of opiate addiction. Welcome to Full Power Living, where we bring you a wide variety of guests and programs with the aim of understanding the power and importance of human emotions. And emotions are certainly part of opiate addiction. Remember that we broadcast over blogtalkradio.com, that's /FPL for Full Power Living, and emotionalpro.com, and we distribute through iTunes. Call us if you have questions or comments. Our toll-free number is 888-498-0570. 888-498-0570. Alex Zafiris, MD, is an integrative family physician. She's a Suboxone specialist, and we'll find out what that is, and neuronutrient specialist practicing in San Francisco, California. She serves as clinical faculty at the University of California, San Francisco, and Touro University College of Osteopathic Medicine. Through her medical office, which is called Care Practice, Dr. Zafiris guides and supports patients with a variety of addictions, all the way from opiates to tobacco to sugar, to lead fuller, substance-free lives. She first introduced the recovery superstar concept in 2011, and through that, she applies the latest advances in neuroplasticity and integrative mental health in a self-directed program so that people are helped with opiate addiction and they can heal their brains at a deeper level and eventually live an opiate-free life. So, Dr. Zafiris, welcome to Full Power Living.
Thank you.
So tell us more about the problem of opiate addiction, including how things have been changing.
Yes. So what we're talking about is, when we say opiates, what are opiates? That's a question people have often. So we're talking about medications like Vicodin or Norco, Percocet, which have the ingredients hydrocodone or oxycodone. We're talking about morphine. We're talking about Dilaudid, fentanyl. These are all prescription opiate medications, strong pain medications that you might get from a doctor or from a hospital after you've had surgery. And we're talking about heroin. These are all medications that go under the class of opiate medications or opiate drugs. And so what's been going on is, first, we have a huge, we've had a huge uptick in the prescribing of these medications going back about the last 15, 20 years, and they've really taken off. And, you know, any teenager that gets wisdom teeth surgery will be given a prescription for Vicodin. And some of those people who take the medication are going to be nauseous in the corner and throwing up, and those people aren't going to become addicted. But if you take some of this medication and you feel fantastic, you feel euphoric, your anxiety goes away, your insecurity goes away, you feel the best you've ever felt. This is what's been missing in your life. That person, unfortunately, their brain is going to remember that rush of that pleasure chemical, those pleasure hormones and neurotransmitters into their brain. Their brain's going to remember that, and they may seek it out again. And if they've got a increased family history, you know, a family history of addiction or alcoholism, if they've got issues like depression or anxiety or history of chronic pain or child abuse or sexual assault, you know, these are the risk factors that make somebody more likely to get addicted. And what we've found is actually a fair number of people have the setup where they may get addicted to these medications. And no one starts out wanting to become addicted, but the drugs are so potent that some people are compelled to take more and more. And people can become physically dependent within just a few weeks or months of use. And then what happens is people continue to need to take the drugs in order to avoid the pain of withdrawal. And that's what addiction is. And we just have so many of these drugs in the marketplace that more and more people are getting access. So that's the first problem. And, you know, the other issues are, you know, we have, interesting society here that has this sort of, we have this sort of allure of safety of prescription pills. You know, we are used to taking pills for our problems. You know, they have, because they're manufactured by a pharmaceutical company, people think they're safer. And there is less contamination than buying heroin, for sure. But just because they're made by a pharmaceutical company doesn't mean they're safe. More people are overdosing from prescription pills now than from heroin and cocaine combined. So this is, they're not safe. They're dangerous. You know, we also have the society. Brené Brown is a wonderful sociologist. A quote from her is that we are the most in-debt, obese, addicted, and medicated adult cohort in U.S. history. And I love that quote because she really summarizes that the essence of our society, that we're used to taking a pill for any problem that we have. You know, think about the overuse of antibiotics for viral infections and people wanting to take diet pills instead of healthy eating and exercise. And, you know, we've really created a society where any pain or distress, you know, needs to be medicated and people feel like there's something wrong with them that needs fixing and all of this, and shame and keeps us silent and suffering. And, you know, we're a society that likes to numb out and distract itself, TV, video games, social media. So prescription painkillers are really just a more extreme step on the continuum, you know, as a way to numb out and distract. And the real problem is, you know, having a society where we people can deal with difficulty and pain and anxiety and insecurity. So, you know, we have this sort of constellation of things. We've had this wide use spread of prescription pain medicines, easy access. They're very potent. They're thought to be safer in a society where we're used to taking pills. So we've really created this epidemic. And what's happening now is we've realized that we've created this problem. And as a doctor, we've partly contributed to it by being a little bit liberal with our use of these medications. You know, when I went to medical school, we learned that pain was the fifth vital sign and that we should treat pain aggressively. And so as doctors, you know, I think we have some responsibility in being part of the solution because we've been part of the problem. And so what's happening now is, you know, these medications are very, very expensive for someone to buy them on the street. You know, if they've crossed over to become addicted and now they're no longer able to get enough from their physician, or multiple physicians, you know, somebody may turn to buying it from the street. And they're very, very expensive. And, you know, it's not uncommon for someone to end up needing to spend, you know, $5,000 or $10,000 a month on these medications to maintain their addiction. And heroin, unfortunately, is a lot cheaper. It's about an eighth or a tenth of the price. And so some of those people have crossed over to using heroin. And this is why we've seen this uptick now in suburban and white communities, middle-class communities, because that was the group that was largely addicted to painkillers. And heroin now has gotten a lot purer. It used to be that you had to shoot heroin in order to get high, and heroin's gotten purer where you can snort it or smoke it. And again, that has a little bit of a less of a stigma associated to it. And so some people who had been addicted to painkillers have switched over to heroin because they can afford it.
My husband, who's now a retired physician himself, was hospitalized in 2011, and I was never so amazed to see how many of these very medications that you talked about were given to him in the matter of 1 week, and he was sent home with them. Fortunately, he knew how addictive they could be and regulated them, but I was just sitting there imagining what would happen if people didn't realize that nobody mentioned, maybe they expected him to know, but nobody mentioned to me as the support person that some of the medications were addictive. They didn't even mention it. So.
Right. There's just so many of these out there. You know, when I do talks on this in larger groups, I ask, you know, who's ever been prescribed one of these medications? And 80% of the hands go up. And then I ask who still has this in their medicine cabinet or in their cupboard. And again, 80% of the hands go up. And
right.
So, you know, there's just so much out there. You know, if you're a teenager who, you know, the teenagers who want to experiment and explore, you know, it's just very easy access. Over 50% of people who start taking them get them for a friend or family for free. You know, of like, oh, you have a migraine. Oh, here, take some, here's some Vicodin. Oh, you have a, you know, menstrual cramps. Here's some Vicodin. And so, you know, you think you're doing somebody a favor, but these shouldn't be shared. They shouldn't be given around. So part of, you know, part of the solution is to just get them out of your house. You know, it's what you as an individual can do.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some in my house. My husband had surgery about 5 or 6 years ago, and I said, what are these still doing here? Like, we need to get rid of these. And to be honest, I actually had a hard time at first figuring out what to do with them. I brought them to our local pharmacy, and they wouldn't take them because they were controlled. And they said, bring them to the police station. I brought them to the police station, and they said, oh, we don't take these. Bring them to the hospital. I brought them to our local hospital, and they said, oh, these came from an outside pharmacy. We don't take these. So I said, oh, my goodness, look at this. I could have sold these on the street faster than I could have gotten rid of them appropriately. And I ended up doing a little research about what the best way to dispose of them is, and actually what the best way that's recommended from the hazardous waste folks and the public health folks is to mix them in some water with either some coffee grounds or some cat litter. And so it makes kind of like a little slurry, so it's not something that somebody could find and then take. So you mix them and put it in the garbage. And if you have any bottles that have your name or your prescription number, to just black those out with a marker. So that's actually the best way to dispose of them if you still have these in your house.
Well, I'm glad. I was holding my breath here to make sure they weren't getting into our water table, because I
exactly.
know there's all kinds of environmental
yes.
things. They probably
exactly.
get burned
yep.
up when
them.
You put them in the garbage collection, so that's good.
Yeah, they do become part of the landfill then, but at least then somebody can't inadvertently use them, and then they're not harming our water supply.
Right.
Exactly right.
Right. So you mentioned that doctors have a responsibility to deal with this problem because doctors have been part of creating the problem. What has modern medicine done to address the opiate addiction we're talking about?
So by and large, what we've had is an abstinence-only approach to addiction that focused on kind of the underlying assumption was that somebody who had addiction was morally loose, that they didn't have willpower, that there was something wrong with them, you know, this sort of like blaming the victim, you know, that this should be criminalized. That's been, by and large, the sort of cultural assumptions that we've been operating under for the last number of years. And the science is proving that wrong, that people aren't weak, they're not morally corrupt, they have a brain disease. Addiction is a brain disease, and from using these medications and drugs, people's brain structurally actually changes, and that is a brain disease, and it needs a medical treatment. And so finally, it feels like, you know, the tide is starting to shift, and the Obama administration, even when they came out now with their new healthcare law, is operating under that assumption, and there's much more of an emphasis on prevention and treatment rather than criminalization. So it does feel as if the tide is starting to turn.
Yay.
And exactly, fortunately. And so, you know, abstinence only is wonderful. 12-step program is an abstinence only approach, and for many people that works. You know, for a lot of drugs like cocaine, meth, marijuana, we don't actually have a very good treatment for it. We don't actually have really any sort of substitution treatments for it.
Mm-hmm.
Opiates, we do. So opiates are a little bit different. Alcohol, we have a few treatments like anabuse mm-hmm. as well. But opiates, we have three treatments actually that are FDA approved. One is methadone that people have probably heard about. It's been around for about 50 years. Another one is Suboxone, is the brand name. The generic name is buprenorphine. It's a little bit of a mouthful. And another one is called naltrexone. Those are three FDA-approved medications for addiction. Now, methadone has some issues with it. For someone to get it for addiction, they have to go to a methadone clinic, which means going once a day to get their dose of medication. It's fairly hard to have a job when you have to go every day to a clinic to pick up a medication. Methadone, people get tolerant to it. They need higher and higher doses. Sometimes people still feel kind of doped up on it. It's not a great medication. Buprenorphine, on the other hand, has been around since about 2000, and primary care doctors like myself can be licensed to prescribe this medication in their offices, which is what I do. And so people come in, and when we find out, you know, they say that they have this kind of a problem, and then one of the treatment options we can offer them is this medication called buprenorphine. And what the nice thing about it is it has a ceiling effect. So there's no reward for continuing to take more and more and more. People feel normal, quote unquote. Within a day or so of taking it, my patients come back and say, I feel normal. I don't feel high. I don't feel drugged. I just feel normal. And they can come into the office and get a longer course, you know, a week, 2 weeks, a month of medication, and they can continue to work. My patients are high-functioning tech folks, software engineers, psychologists, dentists, construction workers, housewives, you know, really the whole gamut of folks. And people can remain in their functional lives as parents and children and have an effective treatment for their addiction. So that's the really nice thing about medications like buprenorphine. And not that many doctors are licensed to do it. We have to just take an extra class, and then you get an extra number on your DEA license, and then you can prescribe this medication. And I will tell you that it's made my life much easier as a doctor because, you know, when someone comes in seeking prescription pain medicine, you know, you can sort of tell, you know, someone comes in saying, I have back pain, nothing else works for me except Percocet. You know, you sort of your antenna go up as a doctor that, oh, this patient is seeking medication. They're probably addicted to it. Now I actually have a treatment that I can offer them in the office that's actually going to treat their problem and not just fuel their addiction. And, you know, it just gives you an opportunity to have a more honest conversation with patients and actually offer them a solution. And patients who have chronic pain, you know, it actually works as a pain medicine too. So it's made my life a lot easier as a doctor, and I feel like I'm part of the solution then.
Uh-huh. But people don't want to end up taking buprenorphine. Uh-huh. They don't want to continue taking it forever. And
that's right.
What your Recovery Superstar program is about. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right, yeah. So people get on the medication, and within a short period of time, they feel normal. And then often people get impatient, like, okay, how long am I going to have to be on this? And what am I going to do to eventually come off of it? So what we know is that 80 to 90% of people who stop taking buprenorphine are going to relapse. That means only 10 or 20% statistically are going to be able to stay clean. So I want my patients to be in that 10 or 20%. So what I've found is that by using the kind of all the latest research that we know based on the neuroscience of the brain about how the brain has this inherent ability to change and grow and recover, it's called plasticity. It's really wonderful. It's like the damage that was caused by the addiction can actually be healed and people can recover. But it takes time. And this is where it's individual, and it depends how long someone had a problem for, how long. What's the rest of their life going? How the rest of their life is it going? Do they have a stable job? Are they having honest conversations in their relationships? How are they dealing with stress and anxiety, depression? Who's in their life supporting them? Do they feel like they're on the right track? You know, these are like all these different elements really go into somebody's recovery and someone who is more likely to be successful in their recovery. And so I've put this all together. This is what I've been doing with patients for the last 3 or 4 years. And then I've put it together as a program that I made a website called recoverysuperstar.com so that I can just spread this information to more people. And this is what I teach people is how to stack the deck in your favor so that you can be in that 10 or 20% and be more likely to stay clean when you come off the medication. And it's using all of the stuff about the latest neuroscience that we know to help the brain heal and recover.
Wow. You know, we're up to our first break, and when we come back, I'd like to have you talk with us about what the structural changes in the brain are and how we go, you know, what exactly you do to stack the deck. All right.
Great.
All right, I'm talking today with Dr. Alex Zafiris. She's the developer of Recovery Superstar, which is at recoverysuperstar.com. And we're talking about also, I'd like to talk about how you teach your patients to hack their brains, which is a term I was not familiar with, as part of the recovery from opiate addictions. We'll be right back. You're listening to Full Power Living. Would you parent your child if he or she were a foreign exchange student? As a host for an exchange student, you'd have 5 main jobs to do. Those are the same five jobs important in raising kids. People around the world have used this approach to raise kids who are self-directed, make great decisions, and are immune to peer pressure. Get your copy of The Exchange Student Model for Parenting, written by me, Eileen Dillon, now available on Kindle. As a 41-year marriage and family therapist, a single, married, step, adoptive, and grandmother, I've got a thing or two to tell you that's going to lighten your load as a parent and help you create incredible kids who will become amazing adults. Go to Kindle.com and download The Exchange Student Model for Parenting today. All right, we're back here on Full Power Living, and I have a couple of announcements I'd like to make before we get started again. I want you to be sure to listen to next week's show because I'll be talking with Paramahansa Jagadish about the World Prayer Project. Paramahansa Jagadish has recognized that our world's in a terrible mess, and so he's inviting people around the world to use the power of prayer to make changes. Well, not a particular kind of prayer. He's open to you praying in whatever way is right for you. And we've invited him so that you can be part of saving the world, of bringing this energy. That's next Thursday, July 31st at 9 a.m. Pacific time. I also would like you to sign up to be on our mailing list. Go to emotionalpro.com and sign up for our mailing list so I can tell you about the many wonderful new things that I'm making available on the internet. One, for example, is that on Wisdom Window, where there's an inexpensive course that I've created on ending codependence. And I also would like you to look for my video course, which I'm in process of setting up, entitled Turning Anger into Enthusiasm, which will be on Udemy, udemy.com. And there's lots I have to tell you about all the wonderful ways in which we can help you with your emotions. So sign up today, emotionalpro.com. So our guest today is Dr. Alex Zafiris. She's an integrative family physician, a suboxone specialist, and neuronutrient specialist who practices in San Francisco, California. And she set up Recovery Superstars so that people everywhere can start working to end their addictions. So if you're within reach of a computer, you can start recovery from opiate addictions. So Dr. Zafiris, tell us what kinds of brain structural changes occur, and as a result, how do we stack the deck so that those changes can be healed?
So you and I have opiate receptors that are in our brain. Those are little seats that when we have a pleasurable experience, we get a rush of that pleasure hormone, that pleasure chemical, endorphin, dopamine, all these are all receptors in our brain. And, you know, that way when we see when we have a hug, a kiss, a conversation with a friend, a great piece of chocolate, a great dinner, you know, these are all pleasure-inducing experiences. The problem is once somebody has started using these external opiates, painkillers or heroin, their brain gets such a rush of these pleasure chemicals that your brain's own endorphins, those receptors start to downregulate. They start to turn off. They start to go away. Use it or lose it. So if your brain doesn't need their own endogenous receptors anymore, it's not going to be making them anymore because your brain is used to seeing this huge rush that's many, many times as potent from the outside. And so when someone has stopped using opiates, it's not like a light switch. We wish it would just be like a light switch. And then just flip it back on, and now you're back to normal. So unfortunately, you know, it takes some time. This is where the brain can heal and recover, but it takes some time. And that's the healing process. It takes some time for your brain's own receptors and its own endorphins to be able to start to kind of get upregulated again. And what I found is it's not just endorphins. It's dopamine, which is the chemical that is involved with helping us feel clear, focus, attention, energy. Serotonin, I think, gets downregulated, which has to do with feeling happy, optimistic, content. And GABA, which is our kind of natural anti-anxiety. So I find that all of the neurotransmitters are actually downregulated when someone's been using opiates. And they can get rebuilt back up, and that's part of what I do with this, with the Recovery Superstar approach, is help somebody learn what is it that my brain needs. And, you know, we talk about the basics. First, food is medicine. You know, most of us have a standard American diet, eating processed food and high fructose corn syrup, and that is not going to feed our brain. Our brain's neurotransmitter, so our ability to make our own endorphins and serotonin comes from amino acids, which comes from protein. So protein in our diet gets broken down, and those get converted so that we can make our own neurotransmitters. And if you don't have enough protein in your diet, then your brain doesn't have the raw materials it needs to make these chemicals. And so that's the first thing, is get feeding your brain. And what else do you need? You need vitamins as cofactors to help. You need vitamin D and all the B vitamins. We need, you know, that our brain is mostly fat. You need good quality fat found in fish oil. So these are some basic fundamental neuronutrients, nutrients for your brain, feed your brain. So we know that based on research that was done, of people who are heroin addicts, 75% of them were deficient in some essential vitamin or mineral that the brain needed. So, you know, most Americans, regardless of whether we have addiction or not, are deficient in some essential nutrient. So it's no surprise that people who have addiction, you know, are even more malnourished. So that's the first thing. And then, you know, I help people identify what specifically their brain needs through questionnaires and through surveys that are on the website that are built in, that someone can just self-assess themselves and hack their brain, if you will. You know, we're in San Francisco, so we have lots of tech entrepreneurs and software engineers where we're always talking about hackathons. And so we're talking about hacking for good for your own health and recovery, too.
You really need to define that. I realize I'm not a techie, but I had to go on the Internet and look it up, what that means. Could you just say what hacking your brain is?
Well, a computer hacker is someone who is savvy to go in into the computer and, you know, be able to, you know, break into the back end on some security, you know, usually has a negative connotation. Someone who can hack a computer, you know, can go into its hardware, into the software in the back and jerry-rig it for some other purpose. So we're talking about just using your savviness to jerry-rig your brain for your own good.
Now, that I like. I can, when I understand it that way. I mean, I understood what hacking was, and I know you can do hacking for good, but I clearly that was an in term, and I'm glad to know what it is. So by hacking the brain, by looking at through these questionnaires and the medical examination or whatever, you pretty much go into the back end of the brain, in essence, and then you can say, okay, you also need this, that, and the other. Is that it? Okay,
yeah.
So what kinds of this, that, and the others are needed?
So there are specific amino acids. So sometimes someone will need to add specific amino acids if they're not getting enough from their diet. You're a therapist, so you know all about the emotional aspect and the negative thinking, and that's a huge piece, you know. So teaching someone to understand what their triggers are, to have skills at their disposal, at their fingertips, for dealing with cravings, and to begin to learn the difference between what a true craving and a false craving is. You know, am I just, you know, in AA terms, they use hungry, angry, lonely, tired. You know, what is it that is your Achilles heel? What's going to be your downfall? What's your vulnerability? And that's where it's about kind of taking the I've created tools so that people can start to have some of that insight, so they can develop some of that self-knowledge and know thyself to such a degree that they can know their vulnerabilities and be proactive in repairing them. You know, there's so much neuroscience now about how to repattern this negative thought patterns. You know, very simple things that someone can be taught how to do, that over 90% of people, when they do these things, these practices, you know, have over 90% of people have less depression and feel happier. You know, simple things like a gratitude practice. You know, there's very good research on these simple kind of tools. You know, it's I'll give you that as an example. You know, that this is one, we have one lesson that's that includes a gratitude practice for people in the class, and it's, you know, before you go to sleep, think of three good things that you noticed today and write them down, and you know, in a journal or a book, and think about why they make you feel good. Why they make you feel good. And that's it. That's a gratitude practice. And, you know, when people do that every day for 2 weeks, you know, they are repatterning their negative thought patterns. They're improving their emotional reactivity, reducing stress. They actually feel happier statistically, even after just 2 weeks of doing this. So it's really wonderful. Simple things that anyone can do. That can really make a big difference in helping to repattern those negative thought patterns. You know, if you are always focusing on the bad and on the negative, you know, that is just continuing the cycle. If you're always focused on, I'm a bad person, I don't deserve to be happy, you know, this is my fault, you know, those thought patterns are going to perpetuate your addiction, mm-hmm. and they're going to make it harder for you to recover. So, you know, these simple tools that help shift our brain, start to focus on the positive, can actually help our brain learn how to be more optimistic. And therapy, of course, is wonderful, and that's a great tool for people who are willing and able to do that, and I encourage that. But to be honest, a lot of my patients aren't really, willing, I guess, is probably the answer. And I encourage people, but probably about 20% of my patients will go forward and follow through on a referral. And so what I've embedded in the course are simple things that I think a therapist in a contained space, you know, that are safe for someone to start to get some of that benefit, even if they're not going to therapy themselves.
I really like that. I personally think there's a lot more we can do, and that brings me to another question I had when I was looking over the outline of the Recovery Superstar program. There's a lot of focus on dealing with difficulties, and I'm thinking to myself, okay, this is like what may be absent in our teaching of young people is how exactly to stick through with something until you get to the end of it, or if something difficult comes up, you don't pop a pill, you deal with the difficulties. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is where you're talking about kind of what kind of society do we have, and, you know, the parenting model where you say good job every single time, you know, or you're so smart to your kid, and, you know, you're not actually doing them a service by actually telling them you're so smart all the time. You're much better off to tell them, to praise their effort, even if they fail. It's great work that was done in a book that they called Nurture Shock, where they talk about that. And, you know, if you tell your kid that they're smart all the time, then and they don't actually succeed at what they're doing, then they're going to think they're dumb, and they're not going to actually try harder. So you're actually sort of sabotaging them by telling them that all the time. But to praise the effort, regardless of the outcome, I think from a parenting point of view, would be a great shift for our society. And, you know, this is what we're talking about. These are people who end up addicted to pain medicine have a lot of trouble dealing with difficulty, either physical difficulty or emotional difficulty. So, and usually they're people who were extremely sensitive. It's what I found. They're mm-hmm. the sort of sensitive people in our society. They're the more sensitive folks, you know, where they feel things even more kind of deeply, either physical pain or emotional pain. And, you know, parents who've lost a child, someone who's had sexual assault, someone who's had chronic pain, these are very big pains. These are very difficult things to deal with. And when you have something at your fingertips that helps you feel better, it is very, very tempting. And mm-hmm. so this is part of the healing process, is to start to be okay with a little bit of difficulty, to start mm-hmm. to be okay with a little bit of pain, that you're not going to die if you have a little bit of pain, and how to be able to start to sit with a little bit of discomfort. And that's what mindfulness is about. The whole mindfulness mm-hmm. practice is about staying in the moment, not being in the past or the future, but to just allow what is for the moment. And if you can just teach someone how to take a moment and just breathe and be in the present moment, I mean, that is therapeutic. That will help them start to deal with whatever the difficulty is that has been so painful that they haven't been able to even look at, that they've needed mm-hmm. to numb out and distract to such a degree by taking these very strong medicines. I mean, that's a very deep healing process if you can help someone start to engage at that level.
Yes, yes. Well, as a person who I was a single parent for a number of years, and also developed a system for parenting. And what I'm hearing very often when I'm teaching is parents who resolve difficulties for their children rather than allowing them to go through the difficulty and learn how to deal with it. So that would be a positive. I mean, that may be a help to keep people from being addicted in the first place, if parents were to realize that children having difficulties and struggling is part of their learning and will actually protect them later on.
That's the teaching resilience part. It's a huge issue.
Tell me more about that.
I'm not an expert in that, but I resonate with what you're saying. I think the more that we can teach our young people to be okay with things not being perfect, you know, that they don't have to be perfect, and that they're not going to succeed all the time, and to be okay with things, you know, as they are. And you know, this is what you're talking about. I mean, I think that's what our society needs more of.
Right. Well, I know I have two birth children that I raised, and when the economic downturn hit, both of them got wiped out in their businesses. Mm-hmm. And yet, in 6 months, they were back up and running and doing better than before. And and it was largely because I really pushed them when they were young. Of course, as a single parent, you have to do that a bit anyway because you can't do everything. But I pushed them, you know, you're having a difficulty. What are you going to do about it? Would you like some help? Well, okay, but this is your part. And I'd really like to see more of that. You use the term mental jujitsu. Is that different from what you've described so far?
It's another way of saying the same thing. It's sort of like how would every pattern these negative thinking. And I have lessons that are within the course that are embedded that are focused on that. Some are focused on nutrition. Some are focused on physical activity and what kind of exercise is the best exercise for you and how to determine that. And you know, the other things that are in the course is you know, one is it's private. We have a lot of people who aren't so comfortable with 12-step because even though it's not called anonymous, often it's not anonymous. You know, if you live in a smaller community or you're somebody more well-known in your community, you may not feel comfortable going to a meeting where it may not be anonymous for you. And so that's part of what I did with the class. And then the other thing is I'm just trying to bring people together and create some community so that people don't feel so alone. You know, we don't heal in isolation. People need each other. And I can't tell you how many times somebody is sitting across from me and I ask them, you know, who else knows about this? And they say, you're the first person I've told. And so that is a huge amount of shame and that is a burden, that that isolation that someone is carrying. And part of the healing is to start to feel like, you know, I'm not alone, and to start to have some compassion for themselves. And that when people start to get to that place, then I know that they're really on the right track in terms of their recovery. I feel a lot more confident in their recovery.
Now, how do you accomplish that when somebody's signing up for an online course, though? How do you accomplish I'm not alone? You have group meetings or group discussions or what?
So far, I've had it as a self-directed class where people do it on their own, and I think for the fall, I'm going to launch a group class because I think it's time. In my pilot, I had it as a group class, and that went well, and I think I'm going to repeat that. Where there's a start date and an end date, and where we can get a group of people all in at the same time. And I may offer like a weekly webinar or a phone if people are interested in that. It's a matter of figuring out what tool is going to be the most useful for people. So I'm totally open. I made the site, and I'm trying to just bring people together and figure out what is let's see where it goes.
Sounds wonderful. So you're in process, the people you work with are. We're up to
No one's really doing this. You know, I looked online, and there's some online psychotherapy. But I don't feel like, I feel like psychotherapy is excellent. I'm a big fan of it, obviously. But I don't think it does some of this more neurochemistry point of view. And I think 12-step is great, and there's 12-step meetings that are online. But I don't think it does this neurochemistry point of view either. And so I really feel like I'm coming from a unique place, and this is a specific you know, program that people can add to what they're already doing. It's not a, it doesn't necessarily have to, you know, it doesn't conflict. It's not in conflict with 12-step or therapy. And frankly, I have a lot of people also who have been, who either took the medication Suboxone or didn't end up taking the medication and just tapered off the opiates on their own and want to be able to stay clean. And I get email messages from folks all the time who say, you know, I'm pregnant now, I'm doing a good job, you know, because I'm pregnant, but I'm really worried about what's going to happen when I have the baby and then I'm going to relapse. And so that's a great person for the class too, because there's so many things that they can do to, again, help their brain heal and recover and stack the deck. So that's another group that would be a great, you know, the class would be applicable for.
So I'll just make this point. Maybe the training of doctors has changed significantly, but I would say you're unique in your interest in many of these areas in the first place and your knowledge of nutrition, that that's not a run-of-the-mill Western scientific medicine group of skills, I guess I would say.
Yeah, I went to UCSF. I'm very grateful for the standard medical education that I got. But along the way, I did a joint MD master's at UC Berkeley and studied osteopathy as part of that, actually, which is a kind of manual medicine that very few MDs are exposed to. And all along the way, my interest was in integrative medicine. And that that was what I found healing to myself and my own health struggles before I went to medical school. This was my second career. And so that was my motivation, was to be a bridge between the complementary worlds and the regular medical world. And I finished an integrative medicine fellowship with Dr. Andrew Weil a few years ago. And that also kind of added to my knowledge base. But this has been my main interest in medicine, was is bringing together kind of the best of alternative medicine with standard medicine. And I think most people are ready for that.
Yeah, that's really great. I met my husband 20 years ago, and I had always been an alternative medicine person. And early in my dating time with him, I looked at him and said, I want you to know that I've spent most of my adult life trying to stay away from people like you. But now
yeah, I had struggles
we're coming
with chronic,
together.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. Yeah, one of my mottos is it's not either or, it's both and more. So, you know,
nice.
I had chronic... Yeah. I had chronic back pain, you know, in my 20s after a car accident, and I went through all the regular medical stuff, physical therapy, and fortunately I didn't end up being prescribed pain medicines at that point, but I still had pain, and I ended up seeing an osteopath, and I had no idea what the heck it was, but I started getting better, and then ended up deciding to go back to school and start studying osteopathy, among other things. So it was an early passion of mine, and now it's manifesting in this way, because I just feel like, you know, in medicine we have very few groups of folks who are motivated to change. You know, we know we have an epidemic of obesity and diabetes in our society, and we all know what we need to do to eat better, but, you know, it's very hard when you drive long distances to commute to work, and it's, you're rushed, and with two-parent families, and, you know, double-income workers, you know, I just feel like as a society, we're just, you know, the structure of our society is not designed to facilitate us making healthy choices. In terms of exercise or healthy eating, you know, everyone is just stressed and rushed, and this is sort of the ills of our generation, I think. Sorry, I lost my train of thought.
Well, I'll tell you what I was thinking about as I was listening to you, is that you are representative of a new direction for medicine and a new breed of doctors, and it's an absolute delight to listen to you, I have to say.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, I know what I was going to say. It's just,
oh, see?
You know, we know that about a motivation. I mean, my opiate addiction patients, I will tell you, are very, very motivated. And these are people who are suffering, who are really like, oh, wow, there's actually something that I can do to help myself. Like, this is not like I'm hopeless, that there's actually something that I can do that's going to help myself feel better, and then I can actually like get over this. And so I find that my opiate patients are very motivated. And as a doctor, it's very satisfying to have a group of people that's motivated, you know, that really wants to get better. And so it makes it very satisfying, to be honest.
Yeah, and I know as a therapist, one of the greatest joys I've had is, I know when I was very young and just starting out, people would bring their problems to me, and I'd go, oh my gosh, what do I do about that? But I've now been doing therapy for over 40 years, and I actually know what can help people. And it's so wonderful to be able to know, okay, you could do this, and it'll bring you out over here. At least it does for most people. So mm-hmm. would you like to give it a try? Right.
Right.
So there are a couple of other things. You talked about how people don't have much compassion for themselves, and I know part of the recovery program that you've created includes loving kindness. What
That's right.
loving kindness things do you do?
Loving kindness is a Buddhist meditation that I first learned from Buddhist teacher Pema Chodron, and it's a meditation that you're guided through it through an audio, and it's basically a way to have positive regard for other people that you feel good about already, people you may feel neutral about, people that you feel not so good about, and eventually yourself. And having compassion for ourselves is hard for a lot of us. It's much easier for us when we're first starting out in this to feel compassion towards another person, a child, you know, somebody suffering. These are much easier ways to start to connect with that emotion. And that's therapeutic. Kristen Neff is a wonderful PhD psychologist who's in UT Austin, and she's a researcher on compassion, self-compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been inspired by her work, and part of what I've done in the course is embedded kind of some of the threads from her work. And what she has found is that she can teach self-compassion through three approaches. One is mindfulness, one is shared common humanity, and the other is self-kindness. And so part of what I've done in the course, actually, I'm telling you the secret now, is I've embedded threads in lessons throughout the course so that people will get that as the sort of secret sauce, if you will. Because I have I'd actually like to do a research study, and if I can get a research assistant. If there's anyone out there who wants to do a research study, I could use a research assistant. I really would love to do. I did it with my pilot, and now I'd like to do it with IRB approval and get a larger, do my larger class. The next class is give some baseline and final surveys. And what I did was I gave Kristen Neff's self-compassion survey, validated scale, psychological scale, to my patients, and I was surprised to see how poorly they scored on self-compassion. And that's where I got the sort of like confirmation that there's something here, and that I don't think anyone's done any research yet on her scale and addiction, but my deep sense is that if we can start to heal that self-loathing almost and start to build some self-compassion, that will have an impact on someone's recovery. I think that's I feel like that's an underlying kind of piece that is critical. I'd like to do some of the research to support that, but that's my hypothesis and my hunch based on my clinical experience working with this group.
Mm-hmm.
And so as much as we can start to embed some healing in that direction, you know, it's not just so simple about take this supplement, you know. It would be so simple as take this supplement. But these are the things that are a little harder to put our finger on, but I think are critical.
It strikes me that really what you're doing is reparenting. It's like it's not just that people have gotten opiates in their system. It's that the opiates sort of found a home because there were so many empty places there or so many negative places.
For some people, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, for some people. Some people don't have that kind of deep wounding, and it's really just
a
physical pain. But
right.
often people have a psychological or emotional wounding as part of it.
Great.
That's less visible. You know, it's harder to put your finger on.
Yes. Now, there are a couple of other things. I noticed that you had shaking as an inner resource. And I know that when animals experience trauma, they shake. Is that the kind of thing that you're talking about?
Yeah, it's similar to that. I learned that from Dr. Jim Gordon, who's a wonderful physician and a psychiatrist who runs the Center for Mind-Body Medicine in D.C., and I did a training course with him called Food as Medicine, and he taught us the shaking as part of that, and I loved it. So, you know, we're talking about mindfulness. We're talking about how do you get yourself out of the kind of repetitive tapes thinking of, oh, I have to, all my to-do list, or, you know, whatever the sort of negative you know, the tapes that we all have running in the background of our minds, sometimes negative, often negative things, but not always. But, you know, how do you sort of just stop that kind of brain, monkey brain, if you will? And breathing exercises are one, but I find that for some of my patients who aren't used to doing any kind of practice with that sitting, often a standing movement is a great way to help calm the mind, but it doesn't look like meditation. And that's what I love about shaking, is it's meditation, but it doesn't look like it. And so the simple practice is put on a song you like and bounce up and down. Just shake your, let your knees be loose and shake your knees. You can shake your arm. You can focus on different parts of the body, and you just kind of let yourself go and just bounce up and down and shake. You know, even if you just did it for a few minutes, it's a great, your brain, you're going to, afterwards, people tend to notice that they weren't thinking anything. You know, they feel more relaxed afterwards. And so it's a mindfulness practice disguised as this innocuous kind of movement and activity.
I'm
so
getting
that's what I really
like
about
those kind.
I do, because, you know, it's like, you know, we all have resistance, and especially my patients with addiction, you know, it's like, oh, you know, you start saying meditation and someone's alarms go off, like, I can't meditate, I don't know how to meditate,
right.
You know, all the resistance goes. So you have to figure out kind of like, how are you going to, you know, snake your way in and sneak in the good stuff without it looking like it's work. And so that's what I like about the shaking. And Jim Gordon teaches this to people after trauma. He was in Haiti after the earthquake down there, and teaching Red Cross volunteers how to do that so that they can teach other, you know, folks down there. So it's
right.
Very simple. It's deceptively simple, and it's deceptively powerful, which is what I love about it. So that's one of the activities in one of the early lessons. I put it early because, you know, I want to build people's experience and confidence in themselves. So it's great. Very, very powerful. Very, very simple to do.
So we have a comment that says, who knew that the disco song Shake Your Booty was therapy?
That's right. Exactly. And so for people who say, oh, I don't know how to dance, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Nobody has to see you. You know, you're just by yourself in your house. So, you're going to start breathing deeper. Your diaphragm is going to start moving. You know, it's just very therapeutic, and it doesn't look
right.
like anything. So that's what I love about
it. And
it
helps you with all those levels that you've been talking about, because, you know, you can't stay angry when your diaphragm is moving. When we hold
on
to anger, we hold our diaphragm frozen, too. So
that's right. And it's going to boost your endorphins. It's going to boost your serotonin. It's going to boost your dopamine. And, you know, it's the secret weapon. So that's what I love about it. I have a lot of those. I mean, that's what the course is. It's all these, like, little secret weapons, these little pearls and gems that I've collected, that I've arranged in a course for someone to do. So,
and I'll make note that it's much cheaper than buying opiates or heroin.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let's say I'm the parent of a teenager or a young adult who lives with me. What things would I notice if that teen or young adult is becoming addicted to opiates? What are the signs? What do I need to look for in myself or someone I love?
You know, I'd say somebody who's more withdrawn, more erratic behavior, isolating themselves. Teenagers are moody, but more moody. You know, some of the stuff can be subtle. You know, kids all have phones and they're all on their own, and you know, going out, you know, on their own and stuff. But you know, I think you want them to be able to talk to you. And so we're talking about the parenting thing again. You know. If there's something difficult going on, you want to try and keep the doors open and those lines of communication open so that your kid can feel comfortable to come to you. And I would say, you know, as much as you can to not judge, you know, it's so easy to judge. But usually the people who are struggling are judging themselves way more than you would judge them. That's what I found in my practice.
Yes.
They're judging themselves way harder than anything that's going to come from me. Especially as a parent, I think it's hard to not rush to judgment, but the more compassion, again, that you have for yourself and for them, the more apt I think they're going to feel comfortable to talk to you.
I once got some feedback from my son who was 16 and told me something very intimate to him. And when I thanked him for sharing that with me, he said, Mom, there's a reason that I tell you such things. Do you want to know what it is? And I said, oh, okay. And he said, if just once in all the years I've been telling you things, you said so much as a, I would never have told you another thing.
Mm-hmm. That's
so
right.
That's the validation of that. Well, our time is up here. I'm just sure there are people and families everywhere, and it will be increasingly so as your Recovery Superstar program gets out, who are grateful that you've paid attention to this topic and that you've taken the time and used your expertise to devise a plan that works to help people come off of opiates and stay off of them. Just as an aside, have you had a chance to do any measurement of how successful, what percentage of people who go through your course actually can get off or do get off of opiate addiction?
That's the study that I want to do through UCSF to quantify this stuff a little bit more.
Okay.
So just anecdotally, I know that my patients who have gone through this program with me and they get to the point where they're tapering and then they're off, they've done well so far. So
great.
I feel like it's had a positive impact on people.
I can't imagine, listening to all the components, I can't imagine that it wouldn't be very, very helpful. And how wonderful that you have to be restoring hope, because your recoverysuperstar.com program says there's hope, you can do this. And
yes,
that's really wonderful.
Yes.
So thank you very much,
thank
Dr.
You.
Zafiris.
Thank you so much. It was
it's
a great conversation.
All right. Thank you.
Too. Mm-hmm.
Next week, join me for my conversation with Paramahansa Jagadish, who is inviting us all to take the pledge for the Prayer Project to effect world change. That's next Thursday, July 31st, 9 a.m. Pacific Time and noon Eastern Time. Paul Johnston of Fresh Talk Media has been our producer. Thank you, Paul. For now, I'm Eileen Dillon, your host, reminding you to pay attention not to what you want to overcome, but to what you want to become.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.